With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Hello, designfootball.com blogger Jay here. You're about to listen to a podcast concerning football design in the 1970s. This podcast was recorded a few weeks ago when I was otherwise engaged and Chris Oakley and guest John Devlin very kindly stepped in. The podcast was clearly in expert hands, not least because Chris and John both existed in the 70s. My apologies to Chris and John for taking so long to get this published, but I'm sure you'll find what follows to be brilliantly insightful and certainly worth the wait. You may have also heard that Chris and Rich Johnson's The Football Attic podcast has returned and is now focused on football kits. This is excellent news. But remember, the designfootball.com podcast is the only one with little tassels on the bottom.
Hello everyone and welcome to the designfootball.com podcast episode 15. My name's Chris Oakley and I'll be your stand-in host today while your regular host Jay takes a well-earned break. He'll be back with you again in the not-too-distant future. Meantime, I'll do my best not to undo all the hard work he's put into this podcast over the last 4 months or so. Today, it gives me great pleasure to welcome back an old friend of the designfootball.com podcast, and that's John Devlin. Hello, John.
Hello, Chris. Nice to speak to you.
Good to talk to you. I trust you're well and fighting fit and raring to go.
I'm holding my own, yes.
Very good. Well, what you do in your own time is neither here nor there. Okay. I can't think of anyone better actually to accompany me as we embark on a trip down memory lane and look back on the football kit design scene of the 1970s. For me, the 1970s is probably the greatest decade of all, I think, when it comes to football kit design, because there was just so much happening back then. What's your take on the 70s? Best ever, or one of the best, or a bit of a mixed bag? What's your view on the 70s?
No, I agree. I think it's one of the best. I mean, I have a soft spot for the 80s, I think. I think that's when things gathered pace. But really, the 70s, that's when we saw that difference between what was going on before to where we are now in, you know, 2016. So really, I think to look at the 70s, we actually need to, first of all, just look at the end of the 60s in a way. Mm. Because I think at that point, kits were fairly, I wouldn't say they were dull, but there were lots of, you know, single colour. You know, we talked recently about the single colour kits we have at the moment, don't we, especially in international football. That was also going on at the end of the 60s. And, you know, no trim, all one colour. And so the 70s sort of kind of threw that out the window and said, right, let's go for it. And it all changed, didn't it?
Of course, yeah, absolutely. Yeah. It's just, I just find that really for my money that you start off in the 70s, you've got these plain, in the UK at least, you've got these kind of plain kits, and then mid-70s things start kind of pepping up and we start seeing the kind of commercial potential for kits. And then at the end of the 70s, things kind of calm down a bit and you get a more sort of refined style that we come to know in the 80s. So you've got like three different eras in the one decade almost.
Definitely. And it's really funny. I mean, I think there's two things that kind of influenced 70s kit design. One was sort of fashion in general, wasn't it? Because, I mean, we're talking the decade of lots of fabric, you know, extra fabric with massive collars and huge flares and stuff like that. There was all those things going on. And, of course, I think it's Aston Villa that are credited with the first kind of wing inset collar that Umbro produced for them. And I think in 69, I think that was the first one that came out. And of course, prior, the 60s was all about crew necks, wasn't it? It was all about little neat and tidy round necks. And I think Villa are credited as bringing that back. And of course, no surprises, it was Umbro that sort of instigated that. But also, someone told me recently, a big influence was the colour TV coming in.
Well, indeed, yes. I was going to come on to that, yes.
Yeah, and I think that then sort of thought, okay, let's get a bit more flamboyant. And I think the 70s, I mean, I think you and I are old enough to remember all of the 70s, aren't we? Pretty much.
Yeah, and I was born in 71, so I'm just about there.
I was born in 69, so I don't remember the first bit, but
no.
I think it was, in many parts, it was quite a beige decade, wasn't it? It was very, very brown. And I think yes. This colour on the pitch really was a massive relief to that.
Absolutely, yeah, indeed. I think that's when companies like Admiral, who I'm sure we'll be talking about in greater length very shortly, really sort of thought, well, now that people are starting to get colour TV, buy colour TV sets for their house, now let's give them something to really look at,
yeah.
Something that's eye-catching, and that's when things moved on so much.
And I think that can't be underestimated. That's when, and we started then to see sashes, didn't we, appear, and
yes.
Even Admiral, the West Ham. So rather than just having the old traditional, body and sleeves, yokes came in, didn't they? And things
yes.
like this, and chevrons, and all. And it's something really exciting did happen. And I think modern kit design owes its origins to that period.
Absolutely, yeah. The 60s as a football kit design decade was all very well, but lots of kits that were black, white, or various shades of grey. That's all I'll say.
Exactly.
At least that's how I remember it. Anyway, let's take that trip down memory lane. As I say, I thought we'd start right at the very beginning of the 1970s with the 1970 World Cup, which, I mean, we're talking about colour TV, the first colour World Cup, essentially, and a joyous festival of football, as many people have said in the past, a really tremendous competition, one of the best, if not the best, depending on who you ask. From an England perspective, of course, England turned up in Mexico to play in all that heat and humidity, sporting what was on the face of it a very regular, ordinary kit. But in fact, Alf Ramsey had seen to it personally that they had a kit that was designed using AirTech's technology. Now, I think a lot of people, it's almost like a throwaway term these days. Oh, it's AirTech's. This fabric which has got lots of tiny holes in it. And essentially that made up the England shirt that was worn in that decade. But for something so that we almost dismiss as being fairly ordinary these days, you had to say, John, back in 1970, that's your foundations then of sort of performance fabrics, the sort of stuff you know today that all your Nikes and Adidas's are coming out with. I mean, that was a big deal, actually, wasn't it?
Definitely, and it's interesting that Sir Alf Ramsey was involved with that, because of course he was always credited. He always used to appear on Umbro logos on the shirts in the 60s. Designed by Alf Ramsey or with Alf Ramsey, and I don't know if it's a bit like the football players that did their columns in Shoot and Match magazine, where they obviously didn't actually write it. But it's interesting that even then his name was linked with, football kit design and technology. But yeah, I mean, I remember being at school in the 70s and lads coming in with, I think it was mainly American football tops that are in the kind of teabag fabric, as we called it.
Yes.
And, the excitement of looking at this stuff, what's this all about? So you can imagine if the internet had been invented in 1970, how much talk there would have been amongst us football kit nerds about AirTech. It would have been incredible. But no, it was very much a forerunner. And of course, the other thing as well, England went out there with a pale blue away shirt, didn't they? Rather than, again, thinking about heat to combat kind of the effects that they thought the red shirts would have. But yeah, so you could see that something was beginning to happen, couldn't you, I think?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, things are sort of starting to move on a bit. And like I said, I mean, I was going to ask you actually, have you ever seen an AirTech shirt, like a soccer football shirt, in real life? Because I've only ever seen pictures on the web, and they probably don't do it justice. But the fabric looks terribly kind of paper thin and a little bit rough and a bit sort of basic. But I mean, I don't know if it really was or not.
I have. I mean, it's going to sound really I don't know what the word is to say this now. I have actually seen and held one of England's AirTech shirts from that period. Shaky had, I think. And it was just amazing how much it shrunk up. When you hold it now, it's like a little child size. It seems to have shrunk in some kind of way. But yeah, it's it was. It's not very sophisticated, I guess, when you look at it now. It is what it is. But it's at the time it would have, you know, I wonder how much difference it actually made. But there's definitely a different look and feel to it. And of course we've got to remember, I must say as well, is that AirTex the brand is spelled AERTEX. Mm-hmm. But I think it's quite commonly referred to as AIRTEX, isn't it? As if it's like Hoover and Hoover kind of thing, you know. I think it's one of those scenarios.
Yeah. It's actually an interesting story. All kinds of things to discuss here. First point I'll take just quickly, because you just mentioned it, which is, you said, I wonder kind of to what extent it actually made a difference. There is, if you go to airtex.com, and I'll admit it, I just did in the last sort of 48 hours because I'm doing my research.
I've done it in the last 48 seconds, actually, Chris. I'm not honest. I'm on it now.
Cheat. There is a video on there which you're going to have to watch later, John. I'm sorry, we're going to have to go on with the podcast, so you won't get a chance to watch it now. There is a video, and I think it's a short film that may have been made by the BBC or somebody like that on one of their programs, and it's just like it's a short excerpt from it. It's a kind of a potted history worth looking at. Actually, it's all about how AirTex came about. And in it, you will see that there's an interview. I don't even know when the video was done, but I'm guessing sometime in the last 5 to 10 years or something. And they've got an interview there with Dave Watson, former England defender, Man City. I'm trying to think of the other teams he played for.
Was it Norwich? Was it
something like that? Norwich, I think, yes. Or actually, there was a second Dave Watson, and he definitely played for Norwich. So I'm not sure. Anyway. But it was the Dave Watson who played regularly for England in the 70s, let's put it that way. And he, rather pleasingly, has still got lots of old shirts, either of his or which he swapped with opponents in international matches. And you see him getting them all out of his black bin bag, which I'm sure is probably not the best way of storing these things, but I'll let him off for that. But he was actually talking about the AirTex fabric, and he said it was an absolute joy to wear those shirts because they did feel so nice and light and delicate, and the material was wonderful. And he said, all the players used to love wearing those AirTex shirts, which kind of goes against what I'm sort of trying to gauge from these fuzzy pictures on Google Images, as you say, and that look a bit like shriveled up, these some of these things. But so apparently it was really good. And he said that in getting into the latter part of the 70s, other companies came along that tried to replicate the effect, if you like, of AirTex, but essentially they were making sort of nylon shirts. It was like knitted nylon almost, and he said those are terrible. He said they used to feel heavier, more coarse, and dare I say, it used to make some of the players' nipples bleed. I'm sorry to get caught about this, but he said that they were so rough that the players had to, you know, put plasters on their chest to stop this rubbing. So he said to wear AirTex was just an absolute joy. So it just goes to show.
So the AirTex fabric then was different from a generic kind of teabag AIR AirTex fabric that other companies would produce.
Well, yeah, they all got into it because, and here's one of the other points I was going to raise, is that I always thought, going back to the whole England thing, is that it was because the kits were made by Umbro, so I thought this was a technology that Umbro had invented or even developed, but that's not the case, as I discovered. In fact, it was, I think the story goes that it was the AirTex company was created by a gentleman called Lewis Haslam. He was a Lancashire mill owner, and cutting the sort of story a bit short, but basically he was out one day in the late 1800s, as you do, with his wife, and it was a cold day, and his wife was wearing these sort of like crocheted gloves, almost very open, lots of big holes running through it, and he held his wife's hand, and her hand was very hot, and he says, "Why is your hand hot?" And it was then that the penny dropped, and he thought, I get it, it's air that's getting trapped in the kind of warp and weft of the material. And that's when the penny dropped, and he thought, right, I'm going to set up a company and I'm going to develop this whole notion of air getting trapped, which gets warmed up by the body and therefore keeps whatever part of the body it is warm. And so therefore AirTex is a company in its own right. But in 1970, it was Umbro who used their technologies, used their patent, if you like, and
as a partnership.
Incorporated into their own shirt. Yes, exactly, as a partnership and put it into their own shirts. I just always assumed it was Umbro. There wasn't a company called AirTex. Turns out I was wrong.
So it was actually used to keep things warm, did you?
Well, that's, and this is the next point I was going to come on to.
Okay. Yes.
Ironically, of course, England wore it in their shirts in 1970 to keep them cooler, let's say. Whereas, in fact, originally it was designed as a way of keeping your body warm by trapping the air in amongst the fabric. And but it's one of those amazing bits of technology that has a kind of flip-flop effect, depending on how you sort of, whether it's hot, it keeps you cool, and vice versa. So it's a clever technology.
It's like a flask, then, in all to intents and purposes.
Yes, exactly. They should have called it thermos technology or something. Yeah,
that's it. And done it in like a tartan pattern. That would have been great, wouldn't it?
See, and you see there, John, that's why you are the designer in these things. You've got the brain for this sort of stuff. Wonderful.
It's funny, you talk about what Dave Watson was saying. I remember, what cup final was it? Was it 79? Arsenal Man United? Is that 79?
Yes.
It was, wasn't it?
Yes, the 5-minute cup final, yes.
I think Arsenal were wearing Air Techs again then. So, and I think when you look at pictures of the shirt close up, it almost seemed the holes were even bigger. It's almost, the proportion of fabric and holes was, I don't know if it changed at all. But it's, I think possibly the last case. I mean, obviously we see the historical kind of like children of Air Techs in virtually every football shirt today, don't we, with panels of holy fabric and under the arms and what have you. Sure. But I remember back in Mexico again, 86 with England, they had essentially the same design of shirt, but again in an Air Techs fabric. So maybe in the early 70s, maybe the layman wouldn't have noticed. But it's the as I say, if the internet had been around, we'd have been all over it, wouldn't we? You can imagine.
All over it. Absolutely, yeah. And as you say, John, I mean, the AirTech technology eventually filtered through to domestic English football throughout the 70s. Even now, if you look hard enough, you'll find on Google and places like that images of people like Man City players from about 1973 wearing a kit. For the life of me, I don't see why you'd need AirTechs other than to keep you warm in England, because you're not going to get like Guadalajara temperatures and humidity in Newcastle, for instance.
No.
But there it is. But it did filter through and was still, as you say, was still being used many years later until companies sort of stylized and developed advances on this kind of thing. But 1970, not necessarily a year that you would associate with great innovation, but it was there.
Interesting.
And I mean, if we're talking about innovation and experimentation, I suppose leading on from that, you get into the early 70s. And another thing that came along in about 1971, the introduction of sock garters, or indeed sock tags, as seen at Leeds United.
Was it that
a wonderful
early?
Thing?
Okay.
That early, yeah. Yeah, and last worn in 1974, so a 3-year period that was worn, or they were worn for. A wonderful relic, John, of football from a bygone era, sort of thing which you think you'd never see again, but it's just, I don't know, I sometimes find it really wonderful to sort of see someone invent something which is fundamentally useless but has its day in the spotlight. And and obviously iconic and joined at the hip with Leeds United, pretty much the best club team in England at the time, really.
Well, that's interesting, because I always thought the sock tags were brought in by Admiral. But if it came in a bit earlier with Leeds, it would have been Umbro that introduced them.
It would have been Umbro, absolutely. That's right. Yeah, it was. Although I think the sock tags themselves were made by a company who's called Melita or Mileta or something like that.
I think something changed in the early 70s. I've got a few old programmes, blimey, I've got about 4,000. But I've got a few old programmes, and there's quite a few, and they talk about a couple of them talk about rules and regulations of kits. And one of the ones was the idea of chain shorts, the fact that you had to wear a different colour pair of shorts to your opponents, which is something that goes in cycles now. But even then, you look at shorts, and shorts started to have numbers on, didn't they, as well? There was a brief period where shorts would have numbers on the front in the early 70s. So I think there was something going on. And of course, the sock tags, the main purpose, I guess, was to have the numbers flapping on the side. Again, was it a practical use, or was it just flamboyance and showing off?
Well, I have it on good authority that the sock garters, as they were originally called, were an invention of a guy called Paul Trevelyan. And he used to go along and watch Tottenham with his son, I think it was, or maybe it was his dad. I can't remember now what the story was. But anyway, I think it was his dad. And he used to hang around in the hope of getting some kind of souvenir, like an autograph from the players and stuff like that. And it just seemed to be that for kids going along that wanted autographs and such, like, there was very little opportunity to get anything like that. So his dad, I think it was, came up with the idea and sort of thought, why not make these little tags that stitch into the socks? And then that way, when the players come off the pitch, they can then take the tags off, sign them and hand them over to fans.
What a nice idea.
A nice idea, and a bit of PR and keeping in good contact with the youngsters and all that sort of thing. So, and the story is, I didn't know this again until very recently, but he actually pitched the idea to Tottenham first, because that's kind of who he supported, and they said, sorry, not interested. So he then thought, next best thing, best team in the country, Leeds United, will go up there and ask them if they're interested. And they knew a good thing when they saw it, and they said, yeah, we'll take those. And that's how they came to be with Leeds. It could have been Tottenham.
You know, it's funny, it's almost like a forerunner of the Premier League names on the back of the shirts, this idea of you know, your heroes, this is your your player. It's that kind of connection between hero status on the pitch and fans again, isn't it? There's that bringing the two together a little bit.
Yeah, and, you know, player identification. I think that same guy actually had a hand in Leeds having names on the back of the player tracksuits as well for exactly the same
reason.
There
you go. Because, I mean, practically, I know that there were home and away sock tags, which, crikey, just excites me beyond belief, the fact that they have different coloured sock tags. But practically, there would have been no use, would they? The ref wouldn't have looked down at the socks to see what number they were. It would have been... But it's interesting. It's interesting. And you mentioned Paul Trevelyan. That name rings a bell. He wasn't the guy who did the You Are the Ref. Is he not an artist, Trevelyan?
Do you know, I'm not sure, but that is ringing vague bells. I think you might be onto something there, John. We'll have to check that at some point.
Yeah, I'm not sure. But so Rigid and sock tags really were not a Umbro, Admiral, whoever. They were this other company, and it was a club thing rather than a sportswear deal, if you like, if you know what I mean.
Yeah,
I remember it. Scotland had them as well, and I think Sunderland, maybe? I'm trying to think off the top of my head.
Oh, Scotland, definitely. I'm trying to think, actually, for Sunderland. But no, that's sort of an independent thing. They just went straight to the club and they said, yep, okay, we'll have those. And as you say, I think Admiral didn't turn up at Leeds until December 73, if memory serves.
That's right.
So they would have been Umbro at the time.
Yeah, but I think Admiral continued with them, didn't they? They obviously kept... In the Admiral era, the club kind of carried on with them. I did see one recently, I think, on a Leeds page, and they look pretty manky now, I believe. You can see them now. It's almost like... you know, like a jock strap. It's like a strap. And it's just a horrible little items. I don't know. I'm sure some have lasted better than others, but they did. It did look a little tired. The one I saw, if I remember.
Yeah, they look a little bit sort of faded, and they also had little tassels on the bottom, didn't they as well?
Just yeah,
a picture of 70s cheesiness.
But isn't that just the 70s? If you could describe the 70s in one phrase, it is having little tassels on the bottom, because everything was a bit... If it wasn't literally like that, it was symbolically like that, wasn't it?
Symbolically, yeah, absolutely.
But that's what's so fun about 70s kits. And of course, I think from a fashion point of view, don't they say that the decades, it doesn't really kick in till about... you know, 3 or 4 years in. Do you know what I mean? Yeah. So 70s fashion didn't really happen until about 73 or whatever. But I think it was all about that little bit of flamboyance, isn't it? Flappy collars and that little bit extra. It was all like, yeah, that'll do, but let's add a little bit more, bit more.
Excess, you know, or something, yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
Yes, you're listening to the designfootball.com podcast, the only one with little tassels on the bottom. I think we've just come up with a slogan for Jay. He'll have to thank us for that and maybe pay us for it later.
Do you know what? I'm sure he will.
Well, I mean, moving on from sock tags, I mean, there was other kind of innovation going on around that time, although you may not have always kind of seen it, because some of these things that were experimented with in around about 73-ish, or maybe even earlier than that, were fleeting and didn't kind of catch on. Therefore, exposure for those ideas didn't really kind of reach a wider audience. But I'm thinking here, we're talking about kind of numbers. I mean, we've got, I think, Halifax... They tried to have numbers on the front of their shirts in 1971, Halifax Town. I don't think they stuck with that very long. This is as a result of a blog post I did on the Football Attic a couple of years ago, I think it was, and stumbling upon these things quite coincidentally, really, but it's amazing what you find when you start digging around. They had like orange shirts with a blue number on the front, which looked a bit peculiar.
Rings a bell, yeah.
But actually chimes with the early days of the NASL, and US soccer fans will be coming onto that as well shortly, so we'll come back to that. Man City, as I'm sure a lot of people know, had numbers on the sleeves of their shirt around about the sort of Malcolm Allison era. So yeah, they were doing that. And one other thing, which I definitely hadn't seen before up until I did this article that I mentioned, was in 1974, Middlesbrough actually had numbers on the back of their socks, if you can imagine such a thing. It was actually on the back of the turnover of the socks. And I found this completely coincidentally. I was watching, I found a video, I was doing some research about Middlesbrough for some reason, and I don't mean that sound as derogatory as it probably did. and I just saw this quick sort of image. I thought, what was that on the back of that person's socks? And you see, I don't know if they were like numbers made out of felt and then were kind of sewn into the back, but it's actually on the back of the turnover, on the back of the socks. And
I didn't realise that.
No, there are images. If you're listening to this podcast on acast.com, which is very likely, then the whole point of why the podcast is there is that you get assistance rather from imagery, so you can actually see some pictures flashing up. So we'll try and get that loaded up so you can see what we're talking about there. I don't know how long they persisted with that, Middlesbrough, but I mean, again, really nice original idea, but then you think, why?
There was definitely
referees. If the referees want a number, they'll just look on the back of your shirt, surely.
Well, that's something to explore. I mean, I think, you know, we are talking, when you mentioned about the sock tags and the fact about players giving them out, and, you know, and I mentioned this link between players on the pitch and the fans. Maybe it was the start of this superstar football era where, you know, having that. Yeah, flamboyant, especially from the Man City and the Melchester Rovers as well. I'm sure you remember having the shirt numbers on their sleeves. You know, that's a real. It's making the shirts really personal to those players, because of course back then there wasn't the great squad rotation that we see now. So you knew that number six for whoever, you knew who roughly it was going to be every week, didn't you? It was that kind of culture. But I also remember as well. I wasn't aware of the Middlesbrough thing at all, but I do remember.
That's very obscure.
For a brief period, I think it was when they had the old penguin-style shirts, Birmingham City, their shorts had the players' initials embroidered on the shorts.
Yes, I've seen that, I think. Yes, now you mentioned it.
So you'd have you know, a TF for Trevor Francis and, you know, whoever.
That's right.
So that was, again, you know, we're looking at these things being almost personalised. And a big thing being made of that. But I remember, I vaguely remember the Halifax seeing a picture of that, but I know Coventry City did it, because there's a picture of the famous Admiral Tramline shirt with a squat, with a shirt number in the front of that as well.
Oh, really? Oh, okay.
Yeah, I'll try and dig that out. But yeah, I know that was around.
That's bound to be a Jimmy Hill innovation, because the great man was always an innovator for that kind of thing.
Sorry, Chris, I think innovation, I'm just pouncing on that. I think that's probably the key word for the 70s. There was a real innovation, more so arguably than perhaps any other decade.
Absolutely, yeah. When you mentioned Trevor Francis and the stitched sort of initials on the shorts, you just triggered off another memory. Didn't Peter Shilton, when he was at Leicester, have like an all-white strip, and he had his initials, didn't he, on his somewhere on like near the badge or something? Or the logo, I think.
There was something to do with that. And yet you would have thought Peter Shilton, I always imagined him to be quite a bit of a
conventional,
quiet character. I didn't see him as a George Best-style look-at-me kind of guy, but I don't know.
Yeah. I'm trying to remember who would have made his kit at the time. I think it was when he was at Leicester, and I'm just trying to rack my brain. It wasn't like a monogram. I think it was an actual sort of stylized PS logo.
You're right. His own personal logo. Fantastic. But when did I know we slight deviation from kits as such, but it is related. When did Alan Ball wear his white boots? Was that 70s or was that earlier?
That was 70s. That would I certainly was wearing those in about 71, as I recall. Right at the start of the decade, if not maybe in the late 60s even, I'm not sure, I'd have to confirm, but definitely as early as 71, I seem to recall.
So we're looking again at an era where things are becoming more identity is becoming more important, isn't it? And people are players are beginning to kind of personality is becoming more driven. And in a way, that kind of you can see how that links into Admiral creating, you know, the replica kit market and bespoke designs. So rather than just wearing an all red top, it was an all red top with this and that and bells and whistles and tassels. It was you can see kind of how that was a natural progression. There was something definitely something in the air at that time.
Definitely, yes, So many things you thought you'd forgotten about, and then suddenly all these things come to mind. But and you know, Peter Marinello, there were other players as well that used to like wearing white boots as well, weren't there? So it's just
okay.
I just, I mean, I shudder to think what people like Brian Clough would have said about players wearing white boots. I don't think you'd have gone very far if you was you were in his team wanting to wear white boots. Anyway, so. That's that. And then, I mean, if we're getting into sort of mid-70s, inevitably we have to mention Admiral because they were the big deal when they arrived. And as I say, I think their first deal was Leeds at the very end, sort of midstream, really, in the middle of the season, taking over from Umbro around about Christmas time, 1973, and stayed with them from that point onwards. I think if anybody ever was to ask me, what's your favourite football kit manufacturer ever, I think I'd have to go for Admiral because they just sort of took the game by the scruff of the neck and sort of said, we've got a chance to really kind of move things forward. As we said earlier on, the advent of colour TV and so on. And they, but the thing is, they could have only moved things on slightly. They could have just had very sort of understated styling. But somebody at Admiral or some people clearly thought, no, we're gonna really like take a huge leap forward now with our designs. And I mean, they were just incredible, weren't they, John? I mean, what's not to like about Admiral?
Oh, it was, do you know, we mentioned earlier, Chris, there's a documentary about Admiral coming out soon that will hopefully really clear a lot of the mystery up and explain what was going on there. But from a design point of view, yes, massive, massive innovation. But of course, we can't ignore, from a business point of view, what they did in terms of what Bert Patrick did, he created a whole industry. Every replica shirt you buy today, arguably, is off the back of what Admiral did in, you know, that early 70s period. Replica shirts did exist to an extent, but they were very kind of informal, casual affairs. And again, I quote this so many times. You go back through any old 70s program in the early part, especially, and you look down the list of souvenirs and memorabilia on the shop page, and you'll see shirt. It'll be about, you know, 3/5 of the way down after ties, pens, panties, all sorts of stuff. You know, the shirt just wasn't considered sacred as we do now. So, I mean, the fact that they said, do you know what, we're going to make this shirt so desirable, we're going to want every kid in the country is going to want to wear the same shirt as their heroes. And, of course, that's where the design came from, because they thought, well, we've got to make them copyrightable so that, you know, not every Tom, Dick and Harry can knock out their own West Ham shirt or, you know, Coventry shirt or whatever. And it kind of came from that, adding colour TV and adding a design ethos which was like, make it as shocking and bold and colourful and big and everything else, and there you go. That's the Admiral recipe. But I mean, it is incredible the legacy that they've left.
But and that's, you know, what makes it all the more frustrating that they're not more sort of prominent these days. But maybe they are bouncing back a little bit. They're starting to kind of get another sort of small foothold in the market at the moment in one or two places.
And they've had these little rebirths now and again. I mean, I think even in the Premier League first season, was there three Admiral teams? Maybe four? I can't remember.
Something like that,
Definitely, you know, two or three. I'd love to see them back. And they deserve to be there. But I think they're, at the moment, and slightly off topic, they're kind of stuck a little bit in the retro heritage and the current. Yeah. I don't know quite where they want to be placed. But in terms of what they did in the 70s, I mean, can you imagine it, seeing these shirts come out, people, you know, we look back on it now and it's like, oh yeah, okay. But at the time, it must have been earth-shattering to the average fan.
Absolutely. I mean, we did the as you'll know, last year we did a special project called the 50 Greatest Football Shirts Ever, which has, I'm sure, been mentioned on this podcast in previous episodes. And on one of the shirts listed was, I think, nominated at least by me, if not other people, which was the West Ham shirt in the late that they had in the late 70s. And I remember actually describing it at the time and thinking, what must people have thought when that came along? It was just exactly as you just said, John. You know, you sort of think people, especially West Ham fans, that can be really kind of, you know, upfront with their views, let's say. And to have seen West Ham players walking out onto pitch suddenly with a shirt that was almost half and half, sort of light blue and claret, rather than the whole of the chest being claret and only the sleeves being blue. And that's before you get on to chevrons, Admiral logos running down the sleeves and trim on the collars. And also there was so much extra detail on many of their kits. And that's therein you have the stark difference between their kits and what had gone before. Just the level of detail and the effort that had gone into making it special.
And almost, you know, the businessman in you could say, well, that was to make them, you know, so nobody else could copy them. It was a copyrighted design. That, of course, we mustn't forget that Admiral paid each club at the time a substantial sum of money to have that exclusivity, which, of course, that relationship didn't exist before. But they also gave value to the kids, didn't they? I mean, I know the shirts were arguably expensive, but when you look at a shirt and it's got little logos on and it's got multicoloured trim, it's that added value.
Yeah.
And, of course, prior to then, the football shirt market was dominated by Bukta and Umbro. So for Admiral to come on, talk about raise the bar, everyone then had to, another cliche, forgive me, up their game and try and catch up with what Admiral had started, didn't they? It was a real massive change.
No, I was just going to say, John, I mean, a purely hypothetical question, but I'm just thinking, if Admiral hadn't done what they did in moving things on design-wise in the way that they did in the mid-70s, how many years do you think it would have been before another company like Umbro or Bukta would have, you know, reached, I'm probably not explaining myself very well here, but...
No, I know what you mean.
They presumably would have taken far longer to have made that leap forward because their designs were much more understated, wouldn't they? I mean, we could have still been in quotes in the dark ages as far as kit design in this country is concerned, much more than we are now if it wasn't for Admiral just giving everything a huge shake and saying,
of course,
we've got to move things on now.
Definitely, and I think it would have happened because you know you can't underestimate with sportswear, especially with football, what was going on the high street as well. So you're looking at glam rock as well, and all these things. There's no coincidence; they all coincide. You're looking at glam rock completely coming out of the denim and long black trench coats of the late 60s. So there was a difference there on what young people were wearing, what people were wearing in general. Colour was coming in much more, but I think it would have taken them a couple of years longer. It needed somebody with Bert Patrick's vision and sort of business acumen and you know, forward thinking to really, really, really shake that up. So they would have got there, but it would have taken them a little while, I think. But of course, the biggest thing with Admiral, which we've kind of not said, is the logos.
Yes.
You know, and I think in the continent, and I think you've mentioned this, you probably know a little bit more about this than me. I think on the continent, logos were appearing at that time, weren't they, on shirts? I think even some sponsors. So Europe was a little bit ahead of us, but I think there were Umbro logos on shirts, but they were way, way down, and where the shirt was tucked into the shorts, a little printed motif there.
Yeah. Well, I was actually wondering about this, because, sorry to jump in there, I was just going to say, I was reading somewhere, somebody sort of said, Admiral, rather, when they started off, they were the first company to have a visible logo on a shirt, commercially, let's say, specifically visible, so that you knew who'd made the shirt. But I sort of think, I'm sure Liverpool in around about 73 had a little Umbro diamond, albeit in black. It probably wasn't as visible as the Admiral logos were, but I'm sure they had a little black diamond logo somewhere. But
if you,
I could be misremembering.
Yeah, I think it's, if I remember correctly, in the even in the very, very early 70s, tracksuits would have a little Umbro logo. And of course, the Umbro logo then was still a diamond, but it was kind of filled in the middle, wasn't it?
Yes, that's right.
Slightly different. The tracksuits would have them, and I believe the odd goalie shirt would crop up, would turn out with a little logo on.
Right.
But it was Admiral that started it. They were the first, but you can imagine, once it was almost like, how did the FA allow this when they'd never allowed this before? But somehow they did. And of course, as soon as they did it once, I think what you then started to see almost, and this is just my imagination, Umbro almost kind of like recalling all the shirts and frantically sticking logos on, because they thought, well, hang on, we can do this now. But it was Admiral that opened that that floodgate. So yes. I don't know whether they broke the rules and the league kind of agreed to do it, or whether they were aware of this change, but certainly once they'd done it, the other companies weren't slow to pounce on it, and of course you can't blame them.
I was just going to say, I think I think probably the FA and the Football League would have been quite complicit in it, because they must have sort of thought to themselves, well, okay, this is actually generating a lot of revenue for clubs, and it's kind of raising the level of publicity and exposure that football in this country is getting. So in a kind of commercial way, it's actually probably a good thing, because it's raising the profile of English football. So we might as well sort of let them go along with it, as long as they don't get sort of too crazy. But then Admiral then sort of said, leave it with us, and next thing you know, you've got Admiral logos all the way down the sleeves and things. But
which was remarkable, really. We've gone from famine to feast there, haven't we? You know, no logos at all, and all of a sudden there's more than you can possibly count on a shirt. But well, again,
I was just gonna say certainly the England shirt with which Admiral had a hand in 74
yeah,
the first England shirt to have an Admiral logo. But anyway, sorry, go on, John.
Well, no, by sheer coincidence, and people will think we've sat down and working from a script here, I'm sure they will. It's exactly what I was going to say, is that we're in the early 70s, we're still looking at the importance of managers and managers, what influence they had around the whole club. And of course, we're looking at Don Revie again with Leeds. Yep. I mean, he was vital to that Admiral deal. And of course, surprise, surprise, vital to the England deal a year later.
That's right.
So again, you're seeing that these managers were much more involved with the sportswear and the clothing and everything else than perhaps people would have given them credit for. But again, another shrewd businessman. It was all part of business. Football, you know, I guess the purist would say that's when commercialism started coming into sport, into football, which of course it did.
Mm-hmm.
But as you said, it was going to happen at some point, I guess. So,
yeah. And I mean, you know, clubs need revenue in order to buy better players, in order to generate more money, and so on and so on and so forth.
Yeah.
But as I know you've said on other podcasts, like the 50 Greatest Football Shirts thing that I mentioned earlier on that we did before, you know, you've said before that players kind of need to feel good in the kit they're wearing to bring out that extra 1-2% to sort of make them play better. And in the early sort of, or mid 70s at least, there must have been lots of young players, stars of the day, who obviously outside of football used to like dressing in fashionable clothes, who must have been thinking, why are we still wearing this old-fashioned stuff? And were probably crying out for a company to come along and say, we're going to give you something a bit more fashionable than that, something that's much more in tune with this modern era. And so they would have like just, you know, jumped at the chance to wear new stuff like that, I'd have thought.
Oh, well, it's like going to a party, isn't it? And going to, you know, as a kid, going to a party and wearing, you know, really out-of-date clobber, and everyone else is wearing the latest gear. You think, oh, crikey, I feel like a fool. It's that kind of thing. And I've seen it even fairly recently when we started to see the sort of skin-tight kits coming back in, more fitted shirts, and going to a game, I won't name the opponents for fear of embarrassing them, watching Southend United play, and Southend looked fairly trim, they were wearing these, you know, Nike team wear stuff, and the other team turned up wearing sort of like late 90s really baggy shirts, and they looked ridiculous because there was that clash of out of date fashion there. So you're quite right, it was a massive leap in it, but I think it is that, and it is that forward thinking and that business acumen, that's what started it all off. And, you know, I guess Don Revie has his part to play in that as well.
Absolutely. I was just going to say another hypothetical question here is an impish one, if you like. Let's say, John, we have a situation where you're watching the news one night and they tell you that there's a huge asteroid that's about to collide with Earth and civilization is about to be wiped out. However, when you hear this news, you happen to be in the football shirt museum and you have a chance to grab three Admiral shirts to save for all eternity for a new civilization to be created. Which are you going to be your three favourite Admiral shirts to go for?
Oh, now, this is the point when I wish you'd asked me this before, because I had to really...
but I was kind of hoping for a more impulsive answer, and I think I've achieved that.
I'm trying to look for my little Admiral book where I did illustrations of every Admiral shirt I could find. I think you've got to go for Coventry uh-huh. home. I'm not going to go down the old brown away kit, isn't it awful, route. I think the Coventry home, yep. with that the tram lines, the three colours, you know, the introduction of a third colour, very important as well to mm-hmm. kids at that time. I think that's got to be there. West Ham, definitely. West Ham home, that's got to be there as well. I think mm-hmm. for, you know, just a really, really good-looking shirt. The Wales tram line is certainly a contender, but we've already got a tram line shirt in there. So, I don't know, would it be... Maybe it'd have to be a Leeds one, Chris, I think. Just a to Leeds give one. Them, you know, as a pioneer, that would have to go.
Yeah. Yeah, no, absolutely.
What about you? What would you think?
Well, before we go on, I just want to say that the look of sheer shock and terror when I put that question to him, you see the look of fear in his eyes, like... What are you asking me this question for? I have no answer for this question. Sorry to throw that on you there, John. I mean, I suppose as a West Ham fan, I'd kind of go for the West Ham one because although there were a few other teams that had the chevrons, it was, excuse me, not necessarily done on a sort of contrasting coloured yoke. So, I mean, that's...
You're right, and they were generally away. They were generally away kits as well, weren't they, the chevrons? I think other teams wore them as away kits more. So, yeah.
Yeah. Definitely. So, I mean, being biased, but I think I'd probably go for West Ham's home kit of the late 70s for that. I was going to go for Wales and their home kit for my tram lines choice, even though the Coventry kits were fantastic. I love the use of red, yellow and green on the home kit that they had. It was just wonderful. I mean,
perfect,
just reeks of the 70s for me. It's just, I just think it's wonderful. And I was sort of probably going to go for something sort of predictable and conventional, but in looking at your website earlier on, John, truecolorsfootballkits.com, and an article that you did some time ago now, there are others there that I'd completely overlooked, and one that I really love, it's just so distinctive to my mind, is the Sheffield United away kit 75-77, which was fundamentally white shirts, white shorts, red socks, but the white shirt had two red diagonal bands, sashes, if you like, going across the shirt in a kind of left to right fashion, whereas if you like to say Crystal Palace, it sort of tends to go sort of left to right, top left to bottom right, if that makes sense, where it's usually the other way around. And every time I see a picture of that kit in my kind of research that I do for various things, it just makes me smile, that shirt. And I think I don't know why, because there's been so many kits in over the years that have had diagonal sashes and things, but a double diagonal sash in red with a little flank of black on both. I just think that's just a joy. I think I definitely had to have that as my third one, actually.
Do you know, when you say that, I'm getting Tony Curry in my head. Would that be right? Was he at the club at the time?
That's right, yes, I think he was,
I can kind of picture that. Yeah, and I think Stoke wore something similar, and I'm not sure whether Umbro introduced that or Admiral. Because they kind of copied, and Admiral just kind of like rebadged it almost, didn't they? It was that kind of thing. No, that's a really good call, that one. And of course, the Sheffield United one is interesting because of its colour choices, because essentially the colour kind of proportions wasn't a million miles away from the home kit, really, was
that's
it?
That's right. Very nice.
Good choice. Good choice.
I was just looking actually the Stoke City kit that you mentioned. The diagonal stripes go in the same direction, but yes, it was made by Umbro, and it was red, black, and red. So it was a triple diagonal sash actually. So but quite similar in many ways.
But of course, again, you know, looking at the sash, I mean, I think the sashes are. It's big at the moment again, Chris, isn't it? There's sashes everywhere. Yeah. And, you know, that's arguably, would you say the one 70s football kit design element that's, you know, ubiquitous to it, to the decade?
Yeah, well, absolutely. And I was really quite pleased when recently, maybe I don't know, 3-4 years ago or something, all the diagonal sashes started to come out. Unfortunately, I think, dare I say, it's become sort of victim of its own success, in that now in some ways it's become a bit overexposed and we're seeing it quite a lot. And although I don't mind diagonal sashes as such, it's like anything, when it's kind of a bit overdone, you start thinking, can we have something else maybe now? I think I predicted last year on one of our podcasts that this season will be the one where we get half and half shirts cropping up a lot. And unfortunately, that didn't turn out to be correct, which shows how much I know. I probably didn't foresee the longevity of the diagonal sash in the modern era.
I must admit, it's lasted more than I thought. But again, going back to what I said about managers, and that was a Malcolm Allison thing, I believe, when he was at Man City, when he brought in, you know, Man City had four kits. They had the blue, the red and black, you know, the old-fashioned traditional away kit, I guess.
Yeah.
And then these, the white and the royal blue. And, of course, it was Allison that brought in at Palace, who are arguably the most famous sash shirts, would you say, from the 70s?
Yeah.
Crystal Palace?
Yeah. Definitely.
But, yeah, it's, and then Man City brought them back again, didn't they, later in the decade under under Umbro. But it's, it just shows again the manager's input, I think. But yeah, I know what you mean about 70s. But I don't mind a bit of a retro feel, but I always think kit should be moving forward.
I don't think
backwards is always a good idea. And you can get stuck in the past a bit, can't you?
Absolutely. Yeah, yeah. It's easy
He says. doing what we do, talking about being stuck in the past. I realise the hypocrisy of that statement, but
don't think I didn't spot the irony in that statement. A little bit of retro every once in a while is fine, but it's like the current thing. I know we're going a bit off topic and we're going a bit kind of contemporary and everything, but I was just saying to somebody on Twitter just the other day about the current fascination with pinstripes. Same thing again. The pinstripes are still hanging around. But anyway, I digress. We're moving off topic. But
with LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Anyway, getting into the latter part of the 70s, there was a bit of a boom going on across the pond, as they say, over in the US. NASL, North American Soccer League, was kind of taking off, and that was a big deal. Finally, the US got its own professional league, as it were, and I think it was started back in about 67-ish, and really peaked in 1975 when Pelé signed for the New York Cosmos, and suddenly every big star was going over there. And lots of British players as well. There was this strange kind of scenario that you had in the late 70s where players were in the Football League were playing sort of half a season in the UK and or maybe during the summer break were going hot-footing it over to the US and playing over there for a while.
That's right,
And club like Trevor Francis was one, and you know, there was stories of, you know, Man City sort of saying, "And when are you coming back? Have you not finished the season? Or you said you were going to come back, you know. We don't mind you going over and playing a few games, but how long are you going to be there for?" And there was all that kind of thing going on. But it was a fascinating time, and not least from the point of view of the football kits that they had over there. I don't know, John, how sort of familiar are you with NASL, and what's your view of that period when suddenly it was almost like the focus on British football was somewhat distracted. Everyone was suddenly going, "Oh, we need to be kind of watching what's going on over there." What was your take on that?
Well, do you know what? I'd love to bluff my way through this, but I'm a very honest chap and I know very little about that period. I have to say, I've always been very focused on British football, I guess, more. So I think I get really excited looking back at continental kits now. But certainly with America, I have got a gap in my sort of knowledge with that. Although, funny enough, we actually went on holiday to Florida when I was 10 in 1980. and that's always my view of American football. I was never very good at football when I was at school, and yet when I went to America and I played with these kids, they all thought I was the next George Best. They thought I was brilliant. And it's a bit like Superman when he comes down from Krypton to Earth. You know, he's treated as a god. It was a bit like that when I went over to America. I guess it just showed the level of, without being patronising, what American football, you know, US football was like. I think, because Admiral really pounced on it, didn't they? I think Adidas produced a lot of the early kits out there.
Absolutely, and
some really innovative designs that we never saw over here. I've got vague memories of half and half shorts. Is that right? And different applications of the logo and.
Yeah, yeah. All that was going on. Absolutely, yeah.
Yeah.
Interestingly, like in the when NASL first started in the late 60s, if you see some of the kits that were being worn then, they were not dissimilar to what you'd have seen in the English Football League or Scotland or whatever in the UK. Very similar kits, except that one or two Maverick teams were wearing, and we come back to this again, we come full circle, numbers on the front of the shirts rather than on the back. But that was just that. That was in sort of certain isolated cases, and then you get into the early 70s, and what you see then is that the teams were really looking to stamp their own identity, not only from the point of view of their own club on US soccer, but also as a national sport. They were just really just freestyling, and the kits that you saw then, there were so many different variations on a theme. Like some teams would have the name of their team on the front of the shirt. Some would have the name of their team and a number on the front of the shirt. Some would have numbers on the sleeves, which you mentioned a moment ago with Man City and so on. Some of them had the name of the player on the back of the shirt, which, of course, we didn't see until, I don't know which World Cup that was, 94, would have been the first World Cup, where it, from a UK point of view, player names on the back of the shirt.
Because I think 1992, the Euro 92 was the first time we saw names on a major tournament, I think. So, yeah.
You're quite right. Yes, yeah. So they were doing all of that way ahead of the UK. And I guess if you're talking about shirt sponsorship, which didn't arrive in UK until 79, would that be about right? Liverpool Hitachi and all that kind of thing. I mean, they didn't have...
Level.
Yeah, they didn't have shirt sponsorship in the US, but they had maybe the logo of their team emblazoned across the front, which must have sown a few seeds, in the UK and in, perhaps on in continental Europe as well, sort of what was possible, that you could have something else on a shirt across
that's
the chest.
That's right. I think you're right. I think, and again, I often quote this, you look at modern fashion now, where, you know, Superdry is the biggest example. Everyone's wearing Superdry. When I came back from holiday, I thought there was some kind of law had been passed that we had to wear Superdry in this country because everyone seemed to have them. I thought, God. Yeah. But it's that kind of mentality that, your shirt looks almost bare without something emblazoned across the front. And I think you're looking at sponsorship and you're looking at, arguably, American football to an extent for that happening. Because you're quite right. You look at the Tampa Bay Rowdies, you know, one of the biggest ones that I remember, for having the sheer, massive, American, glamorous logo on it. And of course, I guess at the time in England, we were a little bit more restrained. It was that kind of, you know, how Americans see us Brits. We're quite, you know, stiff upper lip and all that restrainedness. But it was, the difference was very clear. And of course, one of the ones I often think about, and I think it was it Colorado? We're going to go full circle again, with tassels on their shirts. Do you remember that one?
Yes, the Colorado Caribous.
That's
the team you're looking for. 1978, and they had tassels.
And there you go, we're back to tassels on the bottom again, aren't we? That's, you know, what on earth was happening there? But it was definitely this period of glamour, wasn't it? And being flamboyant on the pitch.
See, the thing for me was, when I was about 9 years old, in which would have been 1980, I got this book called The Encyclopedia of World Soccer. And it had in the back a section called something like 40 Top Clubs in the World or something. And it was basically a little profile where they would list all the honours that each club has won over the years, the name of the manager, name of the captain, blah, 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 blah. And above each of the chosen teams, there was a little diagram of a football player wearing that team's kit. And there was lots of all your big name sort of teams like Juventus, Real Madrid, Manchester United, and so on. but rather sort of, I'm not sure what the word is, like topically, I suppose, they actually had a few NASL teams in there, which I think if you're talking about 40 greatest teams, I think they were just putting that in for a bit of balance and stuff.
Yeah.
But, yeah, and also in the centre pages, they had a feature on football in the US, and they had a big map of the US, and all the club badges were all dotted around, and it was just like football on another planet, and that's how I got into NASL.
It's almost an alternate universe, because I would say that American NASL fashion didn't feed back into Britain, did it? It didn't come back into us. I think it was...
Not directly.
It's almost like... it's like their take on what was going on, and they got it, you know, arguably. Well, not, maybe that's not true. I was going to say arguably they got it a little bit askew, but of course, no, that's what was going on in America at the time. It was the fashions again were slightly different, maybe to what we had here. There wasn't that great crossover, but I think it didn't feed back in. I think the common factor was this idea of graphics on the front of previously plain shirts. That's the biggest kind of common ground.
Yeah,
but. It's funny looking back on that, but it is an area I haven't got a huge amount of knowledge about. I think even then I looked and I thought, you know, gimmicky nonsense. I'm not going to tassels. What the hell's going on? Even at 9 or 10, you know.
Yeah, I'm pleased to say it wasn't all tassels.
But more's the pity, eh?
Yes, we need more tassels in football. But you're quite right, though. Adidas were without question the big team that were providing kits for, I would say, probably of all the teams that ever played in the NASL over a sort of 20-year period, they must have provided kits for about 60% of all the teams that played, at least, if not 70 or 80.
At the beginning, I think, Chris. Admiral pounced, because Admiral kind of effectively gazumped Umbro, didn't they, in the UK?
Yeah.
And I would suggest they gazumped Adidas out in the States, and they seem to really... take that over. So I think Adidas first and maybe Admiral, would that be right, do you reckon?
Yeah, Admiral got there in 77, and they had a number of teams, quite a few teams actually, they provided the kit for. And I think again it was that Bert Patrick sort of ability to sort of spot an opening, really a chance to kind of get his foot in the door, and went over there and started sort of schmoozing with some of the people at the various clubs. So they had kit for Connecticut Bicentennial, Detroit Express, Memphis Rogues, Minnesota Kicks, lots and lots of different clubs they made for. But Umbro weren't out of the picture completely. They did do a few kits for teams like Denver Dynamos and Dallas Tornado and people like that. So they were there, but they had a much lower profile, let's say. It was definitely Admiral that got there first and stamped their mark on it.
I was going to say, it reminds me, and I know you're a great lover of Shoot and Match from back in the day as well. That's what I've got memories of, full page ads with nothing but NASL Admiral shirts in.
Yeah.
Do you remember those?
Absolutely. And I think,
so even, you know, New York Cosmos, Vancouver White, I'm looking now, I'm having to refresh my memory. They did loads. They even had a couple of tram lines out there as well, I believe.
They did. That's right. Yeah. I also vividly remember those adverts in Shoot, you know, California Surf, all these amazingly exotic sounding team names. And it's just there are some absolutely delightful football shirts, not just Admiral, but all, you know, the Adidas designs and so on. If you want to get a good snapshot of some of the kits and the shirts that are out there is a website I thoroughly advise you listeners to go and visit, nasljerseys.com. Somebody there, I'm not sure who, somebody has taken a lot of time and effort and love to put together lots of different photographs and imagery for each team that ever played in the NASL, and you can see so many great pictures of the fabulous, fabulous kits. And I say fabulous, they weren't necessarily innovative designs necessarily, but they looked modern compared to what England had at the time at club level, and that's what I think really makes me excited when I see those kits. They're sort of like UK football kits, but with a sort of large spoonful of pizzazz, Hollywood pizzazz, sort of thrown in.
Excellent. Oh, I'll be right on that, Chris. Actually, when we finish,
you'll be on that the rest of the weekend.
You may just have kind of started a love of NASL shirts for me here. Let's see. Well, there was an Umbro one out there, actually. They did,
yes.
Tampa Bay Rowdies briefly. Oh no. Yeah, I can't. I'll lose focus on what we're doing. So.
There's a kit. One team they did a kit for was the. I have to laugh. It just sounds at odds with my English sensibilities. But the New England Tea Men, Umbro did a kit for them from 1978 to 1980. And there's a picture of. I'm not sure if it was in the Umbro kit that they provided, but there's a guy. I think he used to play for Charlton Athletic called Mike Flanagan, and he briefly played. Yes. One of the UK. Army that went over there and played there, and he played for the New England Tea Men. And there's a picture on that website that I just mentioned, and he's wearing the New England Tea Men kit, and I really love it because it's got a big red sort of T on the front on a yellow shirt, almost a bit kind of vaguely like the big Talbot logo that they had on the Coventry kit, but not as commercialized. But it was like a big T shape on the front of the shirts, and there was some lovely invention on a lot of those NASL jerseys. They're wonderful.
Do you know, I do urge everyone to Google this as soon as you can, because yeah, I've never seen this before. Mm. It is incredible. It's got the number, hasn't it? It's got the shirt number kind of midway down, almost like, you know, discreetly placed. Ridiculous position, really. It's got an Umbro logo that hasn't been reversed out, so it's like red on red kind of style. It's bizarre, but it's really quite unusual. It's like like a distant cousin, isn't it, of America, of English football? It's very strange.
Yes.
Oh, fantastic!
Well, yeah, I mean, there's just that's going to be the whole of your next week written off, folks. If you go to that website, it's wonderful. Whoever's done that, congratulations to you for doing that. But it kind of gives you an interesting juxtaposition if you're looking from a UK perspective of what was going on in the UK and what America were having. And it also provides a bit of an interesting comparison also with continental Europe, because we were mentioning kind of elements on shirts like numbers and team names and stuff like that, sponsors, logos. And just, I mean, in this last section, really, before we have to wrap up, I mean, John, something I discovered in the last few years was that I had to do some research to do some illustrations of the French national team kit over the last 50 years. I did that a few years ago. And the one thing I discovered at that point was that the French national team had an Adidas kit in 1972 with, you know, Adidas stripes on and everything. And that really threw me, because I assumed, being English, that you didn't really see that kind of thing going on. Certainly with English club kits, you didn't see the Adidas logo, the Adidas stripes, until about 77. I think there were a number of teams, Birmingham, Forest, Ipswich and so on. But France had a recognisable Adidas kit in 72. Similarly, I did some research recently on Borussia Dortmund, and they had also, around about 71, 72, you can see on one kit they had, on their black shorts, there was the three... there were three white stripes for Adidas, and the white stripes were actually flanked with a thinner yellow stripe, which is like really sort of almost like 1980s style.
Yeah,
and that was back
definitely.
In about 1971, 72. So suddenly you think, wow, we were in the UK, we were really late to the party in terms of getting on board with Adidas, because they were definitely the prevailing and upcoming brand for football kits in the UK. And at a stroke, I think, unfortunately, made Admiral stuff look a bit old-fashioned, dare I say it. But we seem to be well behind Europe.
Yeah, well, the Adidas thing crops up again with taping, which is, of course, the stripes down the sleeves. And, of course, Umbro had it with their double diamond, Admiral with their logos. But really, that was almost an innovation, possibly, you could say, from Adidas with their trademark three stripes, which is as important to their brand as their logo is. So it's really cunning bit of branding and promotional kind of nous there that they do that. But yeah, I didn't realise that, because that kind of confuses me a bit, because Adidas didn't really want to get that involved with apparel, as you say, until later in that decade. And I think they had that relationship with Umbro, whereby Adidas were firmly all about boots. And had Umbro all about clothing, and they were kind of like, they were partners, weren't they, I think, at the time?
Yes, yeah.
And I think from the how the legend goes, and Shaky will maybe clarify this, in the late 70s, Umbro almost kind of gave them a couple of their contracts, and sort of, you know, being Birmingham, Fulham, Ipswich, they kind of, you know, and Adidas took those over. So the fact that Adidas had dipped their toe in the water that early on is a surprise to me. But I wasn't aware of that.
Well, yeah, and also not only that, but you sort of think, Adidas, you'd be mistaken for thinking that Adidas kits weren't around until about 77. If you go back to see footage of the 74 World Cup, about 80 to 90% of the teams are wearing Adidas kits. So actually, it was a kind of well-known thing. It's just you forget sometimes that actually they've been around a bit longer than you think.
Yeah, and I think funnily, I do. You know, when it comes to my kit kind of obsession, I'm a little bit UK centric, I guess. Mm. And you're absolutely right. I think with the Birmingham Ipswich thing, I think that was Adidas maybe getting into the UK football shirt market rather than in general, because as you quite rightly say, 74 was all over it. I mean, that's the Cruyff final with the Cruyff tournaments with the stripe removed, wasn't it? So
yes,
Adidas were massively around then. I think it was really in the UK that they wanted to make real inroads into British football shirts at the time. Did the French shirt have the logo on as well?
It did, yeah. Just only the trefoil. They didn't have the word Adidas initially, but that came along later. But and the same can be said. I'm sure this was the case probably in many parts of continental Europe at the time, certainly in France and West Germany, if not, I think probably countries like Italy and Spain would have been a little bit sort of hesitant at first to get on board with Adidas. Going for their own sort of brands and things, but
so Holland as well were another one, but of course I think in 74 in the World Cup finals there were no trefoil logos on there, but that's arguably a FIFA rule, no branding on the shirts, I guess, which is why Adidas was so cunning, because they said well, no branding on the shirts, but we've got three stripes going down the side, and you know, we all know who that is. So it dominates what they did. But again, something that's no more 70s than taping, is it? Stripes down the sleeve.
Exactly, yeah. I mean, it's remarkable, actually, when you watch the 74 World Cup on YouTube and the number of teams that were wearing Adidas kit, and it looks so modern that for its era, like Yugoslavia, Zaire, it goes on and on. And especially when you see, like, there's one match, I think, that Scotland played Yugoslavia, and Scotland are wearing this, what seemed to be at the time like a very old-fashioned, probably an Umbro kit, I'm guessing, with a kind of triangular, I think it had a triangular little in panel under the neck. And then you got Yugoslavia wearing this sleek kind of all-white kit with I think it was all white anyway, with the three stripes down the sleeves. And it just looks like two different eras on the same pitch as far as the styling's concerned. It's quite jarring, actually.
I'll have to check that out again. I think, again, we're back to what we talked about at the beginning. It's innovation, isn't it? It's a decade where, you know, arguably things really, you really had to keep up with what other companies were doing. So you had to follow for fear of being left behind completely.
Yeah.
A lot of innovation. Interesting stuff.
I think I might have got the two teams mixed up, got their home and away kits mixed up. But the point I'm making is at least that there were different styles. I think it might have been Yugoslavia in blue and Scotland in white or something like that. But you can see the comparison in styles and just Adidas with three stripes. It just looks so much more sort of understated and stylish than, dare I say, the likes of the Admiral tape, although it was fine for the era that it was born in. But and also obviously on the continent, they were going for big sponsors logos, like massive sponsors logos. I think we've gone all the way down memory lane from the start of the 70s to the very end. We've sort of stopped off at Admiral and NASL and sock tags and all sorts besides. And it's probably time now, John, for us to put our tassels away and call this podcast closed. just want to basically give you some details, essentially, of how you can join in the conversation. If you want to send your views to Jay and talk about football kit design in the 70s, you certainly can do. Basically, you need to go along to designfootball.com. That's where you can find all the links pointing to this podcast and all the others. And you can also follow Design Football on Twitter. Search for designfootball.com on Twitter and Facebook. Follow your nose. You'll get to all the relevant stations as you see fit. As I say, this podcast is also available via acast.com/thedesignfootballpodcast. Drop Jay a line if you can and let him know your views and all that. Similarly, you can talk to me and John if you're really that desperate. You can find us on Twitter as well. John's on Twitter at True Colours Kits. And you're also strongly advised to visit his website as well, truecolorsfootballkits.com. You'll find his wonderful website there, full of fantastic imagery and illustrations of football kits from the past and indeed the present. And if you want to follow me on Twitter, you can do at Chris Oakley, C-H-R-I-S-O-A-K-L-E-Y. And my website, should you want to visit it, is called Kitbliss, and you can find that at kitbliss.co.nz. It's a little project that I've had going for a while there. Similar sort of thing, football kit illustrations and so on. So that's how you can get in touch with us. But John, I think that's pretty much it. We're out of time, but it's been an absolute joy talking to you and reminiscing in this way.
It's been brilliant, Chris. I've really enjoyed it. And it's great to become totally immersed in a specific area of kit design. Brilliant.
Absolutely, yep. Keep the memories alive and all that. That's what it's all about. And listeners, thank you very much indeed for your time. And thank you for having me on this podcast, Jay. And until next time, from the two of us, John and myself, it's goodbye to you all.
Goodbye. Thank you, Chris. Bye.
Goodbye.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.